All right, good morning, everyone. For the next 50 minutes, we're going to be discussing commodities, and I'm pretty sure what I'm about to say is going to be the understatement of the conference, but it's been a rough ride for commodity investors. Over the past 6 years, the Bloomberg Commodity Index is down about 50%. Over the same time frame, global equities have returned 61%, and U.S. fixed income has returned 20%. So what's been driving this underperformance? So far this year, the Bloomberg Commodity Index is down roughly 8%. Is there more pain to come, or is there reasons for optimism going forward? So we have a great panel here that's going to help shed insights into investing into commodities in the current environment. We'll get into performance. We'll get into our outlooks. There'll also be time for questions at the end. We'll identify areas of opportunity. So before we get started with the questions, I just want to have the panelists briefly introduce themselves. Let's start with you, Max.
Hello, my name is Maxwell Gold. I'm the Director of Investment Strategy at ETF Securities. ETF Securities is a global ETF provider with a presence in Europe, U.S., and the Pacific. And overall, we manage about $22 billion, predominantly anchored in precious metals and commodities, but as well as exposures to other asset classes.
I'm Kurt Nelson. I'm a partner at Summerhaven Investment Management. We're an independent commodity manager, diversified commodity portfolios. Among other things, we have the USCI ETF, and manage the index, Summerhaven Dynamic Commodity Index, as well as trading the securities in that ETF.
My name is Sal Gilberti. I'm the founder of Tucrium. We are sponsors and issuers of agricultural, single commodity agricultural ETFs on the New York Stock Exchange, providing people with direct exposure to corn, soybeans, wheat, and sugar.
All right, great. So my first question is going to be for Sal, and many commodity indices, they get their exposure through the futures market, and I'm sure it's going to come up in our discussion this morning. So, Sal, could you just provide a quick overview of investing in commodity futures and sort of the benefits and risks?
Sure. And we're here talking about ETFs, so I'll keep it in the context of futures inside the ETF wrapper. To put futures inside ETF wrapper, I think, was a brilliant idea. It is something that allows investors who are not allowed to trade futures, who want direct access to commodities, to enter into those spaces and gain that exposure through an ETF traded on a stock exchange. Now, futures are somewhat complicated, as people may hear. You know, you hear the joke that you might get a bunch of pork bellies, which no longer trade, by the way, but delivered to you. That's not actually how it works. And futures are very liquid. They're very efficiently priced because, by and large, they're used by the trade, the people who grow those particular commodities or produce those particular commodities. And so pricing inefficiencies are rare. Pricing efficiency is the norm for the futures curve. So futures inside of an ETF wrapper help with, number one, liquidity. In fact, during the crashes that you've heard people talking about before, all of the futures ETFs, the commodity futures ETFs, never missed a beat. Their pricing was perfect. It was flawless because the futures markets never missed a beat. So we reflect the underlying. Other than with precious metals, where a case can be made, where you want to invest in a physical, you're far better off investing in a wrapper that contains futures, because storage costs of, you know, of gold, an ounce of gold is pretty small. Everybody knows what it looks like. It's worth $1,200, $1,300. You put a big pile of gold in a secure room with guards around it, it's actually really cost efficient to store billions of dollars worth of gold. Whereas a bushel of corn, everyone knows about how big a bushel is. It weighs 56 pounds, and it goes bad. You can keep corn for about 4 years, and then it's gone. So you have storage costs. Same with oil. Oil actually goes bad. It loses its properties in storage. And so what you want is exposure to futures, and there are different types of exposures to futures. There's a lot of criticism that you don't get what you think you were getting when you buy or sell a futures-based ETF. In particular, oil gets picked on a lot. But all that means is some of these things look inside your ETF. So if it's holding spot oil and rolling it every month, there may be roll inefficiencies that cost you money. So that's a short-term trade. If you have a short-term view on oil, very short-term, 4 to 6 weeks, that's actually a very good vehicle to use. If you're asset allocating to oil, that's a poor vehicle to use. Look inside and see who owns down the curve and has an efficient roll model or future selector within that. Also, in some cases, and it's individual, you have to check, the tax efficiency is much greater when owning futures versus physical.
All right, thanks. That's going to be helpful because roll yields are going to come up throughout our talk. So my next question is just for the panel. The performance discrepancy between commodities and equities has definitely led to investors reassessing their allocations to commodities. So I just want to ask the panel, what role do you see for commodities in portfolios? Is there still a longer-term diversifying benefit, or should commodities be for more shorter-term tactical trades? Whoever wants to do it, start, Max.
Yeah, I mean, I'll jump out right there. So, my perspective, my framework of how I view commodities is that they're a key asset class. They provide some unique diversification benefits. They can help reduce your portfolio volatility. And I think that's sort of a mixed message compared to the average investor or advisor out there. If they're looking to incorporate commodities, they view it maybe as a tactical play. Some view it as a strategic play. But overall, I think you can sort of mend both sides of that. I do think that there is efficiencies from including both precious metals as well as broad commodities into your portfolio. They have unique factor exposures, which is a key part of portfolio construction. Is a lot of investors focus on very much return drivers. And my starting point is always, where are my risks? Where are my exposures? What are the factors that are driving these asset classes? And overall, if you look at broad commodities as well as precious metals, and we do see some cyclical factors, some inflationary factors, but more importantly, the fundamentals, the supply and demand of what drives production of oil, what drives demand of oil, what drives production of gold and silver versus demand. There are different phases that come on at different points over a full economic cycle. And when you put that together in context with a diversified stock bond portfolio, you do see efficiencies increase. You do see your return begin to increase slightly. And more importantly, you see your volatility and your risk factors begin to reduce. And that's really the power where I view precious metals and commodities as a key diversifying asset, as a risk management tool, as a way to get unique factor exposures beyond those that would drive financial assets like equities, like fixed income, especially in this environment where I think a lot of investors are beginning to question where do we stand from a valuation standpoint. And I think that certainly on a relative value basis, commodities are beginning to look much more so attractive with some macro and fundamental tailwinds behind them.
So I would add, there's really three reasons why you would want to own diversified commodities in a portfolio. The first is for diversification. It's kind of hard to argue that they're not diversifying if you have both stocks and bonds, traditional assets going up a lot, commodities have been going down. It might not be the right way for a commodity portfolio, but it is diversifying. There's certainly negative correlation there. And if you look at over, 60, 70, 80 years, the long-run correlation between commodities and bonds and commodities and stocks is zero or slightly negative. The second reason why you'd want to own commodities is the positive inflation hedge. I think that there's some complacency about inflation. We thought there would be a lot of inflation after QE1 and 2. In fact, if you look at the TIPS break-even rates, they spiked in kind of 2010, 2011. Expectations of inflation were very high. Certainly the Fed thought there would be. There were a lot of concerns in the press about the printing of money, trillions of dollars, and what that would, what kind of inflationary effects we'd see. Commodities went up. We had our ETF was in the market at that time. We went up 44% in 8 months. And that was similar for BCOM and for other broad betas in the commodity space. What actually happened is that we've had disinflation. We've had low inflation that's gone lower and lower, closer to zero, made central bankers very, very nervous. And in fact, they've publicly stated, whether it's Janet Yellen and Stan Fisher or Draghi in Europe or Kuroda in Japan, that they're going to stoke inflation. They will not allow a deflation trap to happen. Well, this lower and lower rates of inflation have been really good for bonds and for equities, for traditional assets. And we can kind of know, before the fact that if you're going to be in a disinflationary environment, bonds are going to do well, interest rates are going to be going lower and lower. And it's probably a good backdrop for equities. It's a bad backdrop for commodities. But where are we going forward? Are rates going to go lower and lower to zero? Are we going to allow deflation? Are central bankers going to allow deflation to happen? Or are we going to look at more of a sideways kind of drift in inflation, or maybe some positive inflation shocks? The third reason why you don't commodities, which is probably more controversial, is the positive return. If you look at this last decade, it's been painful for commodities. But if you look at a much longer term, if you look at over 50, 60, 80, 100 years, and we have all the data to support this, a diversified commodity investment exceeds the risk-free rate by about 4 to 5%. With about a 15 to 17 vol, something comparable to equities. I think of diversified commodities a lot like an equity risk profile. But because of the underlying macro factors, it tends to zig when stocks zag. So those are the three reasons. And I think that they've been challenged, particularly the return expectation over this last experience of the last few years. But I think that tactically timing commodities is just as easy as it is in the equity market. So if you have a simple kind of, you can scribble it on a napkin rule to when you're going to buy and sell the S&P 500 and do that really capably, I'd like to know what that idea is. See me in the break after. There isn't anything similar for commodities. And so I think that while you might tactically overweight or underweight, I think it makes much more sense to kind of come up with a strategic allocation that you think fits. You can put the fundamentals into a CAPM model, come up with a strategic long-term weight, and then diversify like you do with all your other assets.
Thank you. Sal?
I would agree. It's proven that commodities, having a broad-based commodity index, and I own USCI, it's not paying me to say that, but I do. It really does reduce your volatility, and therefore it increases your risk-adjusted returns. Every study we've done 20 years or longer, sometimes your absolute returns of your portfolio are up a couple of bips, sometimes they're down a couple of bips, but the volatility, the standard deviation of your portfolio, including a well-rounded balance of commodities exposure, really does reduce your volatility, and so your risk-adjusted returns go up. Just a quick example. People don't understand. They say, well, wait a minute. I take some of my stocks, which are volatile, and I replace them with commodities, which are slightly more volatile. How does that help me? Well, if you're a good stock picker, let's say in the transport sector, over time, your transport stocks that you own are going to go up. But that shock that comes when oil goes from 40 to 80 overnight because of something happens, it crushes those transport stocks. It's their largest input of cost. As they go down, if you own oil, it goes up. It offsets in your portfolio, and that's how it actually drops the volatility. Over time, because you're a good stock picker, those transport stocks that you own will learn how to operate in a higher-priced oil environment. But that quarter where the impact happened, the gain in the commodity offsets the loss in the equities that you own, and that's how it drops the volatility in the portfolio.
And that's a good sort of lead into the next question, because the whole interplay of, like, equities versus commodities and the performance discrepancy we've seen. So some investors, rather than going for the direct commodity exposure, are trying to get that exposure indirectly by playing commodity-related equities. So my question is just, or what are the trade-offs between getting that direct exposure to commodities versus trying to play the exposure through commodity-related equities?
Yeah, I think that this gets brought up a lot, especially when we are in a bull market for equities. We do see a strong run-up, more the case for the miners, the producers, the agribusiness. And I think that's fine, but what you have to take into consideration is that an investment in these equity producers is an investment in equity, and that entails the same risks and factors and drivers of what drives equity markets. A perfect example is, say, take the miners versus metals. If you look at them, you say, okay, this is just a lever play on the spot price of aluminum or copper or gold. And that's not really the case. Is if you actually look at it, the way that I think about including commodities from a diversification standpoint is I want sort of those low uncorrelated assets to equity markets. That doesn't really come up if I'm doubling down on my exposure to on the equity for a producer or a miner. A great example is gold. Gold's well known for its ability to hedge. But if you actually look at whenever the S&P has dropped peak to trough by 10% or more over the past 30 years, miners were down about 7% on a total return basis over those periods when the S&P on average was down 20%. And gold is actually up 7%. So that 14% differential between the underlying commodity and the producers is inherent because what drives the equity side of the natural resource equities, in my view, is much more the profitability, their capital structure, their industry outlook, and the position in their industry, as well as their earnings expectation. We've seen a lot of cost reductions, a lot of debt repayments recently that has acted as a boost to a lot of these producers, and that's helped in their margin expansion and their stock prices. But that doesn't necessarily give you the exposure of what's driving the fundamentals of supply and demand that's inherent in provides the unique diversification benefits of commodities in physical form or in futures contracts.
And just to echo what Max has been saying about equities, I think they're just different. Commodity equities, you carry some enterprise risk. You've got CEOs and board and leaders who may be hedging, so they may be actually reducing exposure to the underlying commodity. You also have access to different markets. So, for example, you can't really buy steel futures, but if you can invest in steel companies, coal companies. So you can access different markets. You can't be as surgical as you can with Tucrium in going after specifically wheat or corn or soybeans. In the equity markets, it's kind of hard to buy just a company dedicated just to corn in the equity markets, but you can in the futures markets. So those are some important differences. The other thing I'd say is that I think of them as temporal differences. You know, commodity futures are processed, refined commodities ready for delivery into production. As by definition, if you take physical delivery at exchange, it's going to be something you can immediately use as an input. And I think of an investment in equities as sort of being an investment in the raw material in the ground before it's resourced. So it might be an investment in a mining company where they're extracting that raw material from the ground, or an oil company or energy company where they're pulling up gas and oil, maybe from fracking enterprises or other things. So in that sense, you know, the equities, they're sourcing and locating and extracting that raw material, whereas commodity futures is a different time stream. It's already been extracted, refined, processed, standardized, and ready for delivery.
Equities, I think you should own both. I think equities that are involved in commodities. I started at Cargill, so we extracted value from the commodity regardless of the price. And I think that's what these companies do. And so when you see these natural resource and commodities companies, they are learning how to operate in any price environment of the underlying commodity. Granted, bear markets, you know, they're sometimes become less efficient temporarily. But those companies' job is to extract value from a commodity regardless of its price. So if you own both, it's a balance and good exposure.
Right, great. And Kurt, you start touching on inflation, and that's one of the use cases for commodities is to hedge against rising inflation. So my question for the panel is, how would you position within commodities if your objective is to hedge inflation risks?
I think maybe a couple things on that. One is that we've studied inflation back, actually all the way back to the Revolutionary War in the United States, and we have futures data that goes back to the 1800s, but spot data that goes all the way back to the beginning of the country. And if you look at that and you look at any individual commodity, we probably have 20, 30 commodities where we have a continuous 200-year price series for. And we have U.S. CPI, and you can look at stocks and bonds over the same period. But when you look at any individual commodity, it has, on average, about a 30% correlation with nominal inflation. Turns out gold or energy products aren't really predicting any better. I think gold has a 29% correlation, just year-over-year changes over more than a century. When you equally weight that basket and create a diversified index and just rebalance to equal weights every year, your correlation goes to 65%. And what happens is all these idiosyncratic risks to the copper market, the coal market, the gold market, weather patterns and other things that can affect agriculture, et cetera, those things get diversified away, and the common factor that every commodity has is inflation, and you load up on that common factor. So I think diversified commodities are a really great way to address increasing inflation and inflation shocks. The other thing I'd add is we've studied inflation as well as inflation shocks, and we were troubled by, in the early 80s, inflation was still very high, and yet the diversified commodities pool, our portfolio, did really poorly in 80, 81, 82, even though inflation was still nominally high. So why was that? Well, it was being marched down by a very, very active Fed, by Volcker, fighting inflation. And so it was really that first moment or that first derivative. The rate of change of inflation was negative, even though it was at a high level. And that kind of was an insight for us to go look at the rate of change of inflation rather than whether it's just high or low. And this was incredibly informative. So in periods where, over the last 60 years, where inflation decreases year over year, stocks and bonds do great, and commodities have a negative real return. And we know that empirically, and that's what's happened the last few years. A third of the time in the last 60 years when inflation increased year over year, both stocks and bonds at the same time had negative real returns of around 1% to 3%, and commodities yielded a positive 17% above the risk-free rate. So I think with respect to inflation shocks, it's kind of indisputable that diversified commodities are a great hedging tool.
Great. Max, yourself?
Yeah, just to jump in on that as well. I definitely agree with what Kurt said. And just in order to also follow up is, you know, where I view diversified commodity exposure, such as like, say, a Bloomberg commodity index, I definitely see the, you know, they are, have a much higher inflation sensitivity in certain economic periods. The highest that, you know, based on analysis I've run is that when we have a high increasing growth as measured by increasing PMIs and output, we do see that high growth, high inflation period to be sort of the period where broad commodity exposures, diversified commodities, tend to outperform other asset classes like equities, like fixed income, cash, and even other real assets. And so I think that that's an important period, important fact, especially where I think where we are is a lot of concerns right now with inflation expectations sort of moderating, but I still think we're at a much higher inflationary level from where we are in recent years, as well as we're continuing to see robust increasing growth globally. I think part of the issue is that a lot of investors, when they think inflation, they think, oh, CPI, PCE. And I think that's inflation versus inflationary pressures. There are a lot of more inflationary pressures out there beyond just what the CPI or inflation index says. A great example would be your local currency. You know, we are seeing a weaker dollar year to date. That's inherently inflationary to U.S. investors. If you consume or invest or earn income in U.S. dollars, your dollar is now weaker, and essentially that's inherently inflationary, making everything else more expensive. There's other types of form of inflation, such as producer inflation, as well as we do see other wage inflation. We're seeing a tighter labor market. That's beginning to bid up, you know, cost of input and services, which overall does sync up to the broad inflationary pressures and increase that we're seeing. So I think that if you think about inflation, where we do see commodities both on a realized and inflation surprise basis have a high correlation, you should think beyond just what is happening with CPI. You should look toward producer inflation, labor markets, currencies, because these are all inherently inflationary and tend to move in sync with commodities.
I can
good?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, so at this point, I'm going to want to move to focus on some different areas of the commodity market. So I'll start with Sal, and just what's your outlook on the agricultural space?
Well, ags are interesting, and in talking about inflation, ags actually have the lowest correlation when you do long-term studies of the commodities traded in ETFs, not ETNs, against the S&P 500. When we do those studies, the grains and sugar and natural gas are almost always, sometimes natural gas in there, sometimes isn't, but grains and sugar, and by grains we mean corn, soybeans, and wheat, they're the least correlated to the S&P 500 of all of the commodities over these 20-year snapshot periods, and we redo that every year. You can find it on our website. People are shocked at that, but I think that the current 20-year look back from December 31st, 2016 has natural gas as the least correlated, and then corn, sugar, and wheat. What's the last thing you do? Last thing anyone will do for themselves, their family, or their animals is allow them to be cold or hungry. So you're using energy and ags, no matter what, no matter who the president is, no matter what inflation rate is, no matter what the latest technology is, you don't stop using those things. The demand is really, really inelastic, if you will. And in fact, it's growing. So if you step back and look at, do we have a slide? We have one slide, so I don't miss anything. Okay, population is the biggest thing. The global population is increasing by about 75 to 78 million people a year. That's twice the size of California. So twice the population of California is added every single year to the earth. In order to support that, you need to add about 13.5 million acres of arable land just to grow the corn, soybeans, and wheat for those new people. And that's every year. That's about half of the land currently used in California right now for all agriculture. So that amount of land is to be added every year. That's a big factor for all commodities, but for ags in particular. Increasing global middle class, this is not insignificant. The Brookings Institution has run a study looking at every country in the world, and they predict in the next 13 years, by 2030, the middle class, and that can be defined as people having as little as $10 extra spending money a day, depending on where they are on the globe, will increase by 1.2 billion people. Why is that significant? Because the first thing people do when they get a little bit of disposable income is increase the animal-based protein consumption in their diet. That means you need agriculture, particularly grains, to feed all of those animals. And that's going to happen even if the population were to stop growing. the middle class is expanding because of economies and emerging market growth. And so those 1.2 million people that are, billion people that are coming on, they're going to start eating more animal-based protein, and then they start behaving like Americans. And that means they use a lot more stuff in their day-to-day lives. A simple example is the difference between corn and wheat. The average person on the globe uses 5 bushels of corn a year and 4 bushels of wheat a year. So they use 25% more corn than wheat. Everybody knows how they eat wheat. You eat and you're using wheat. But the average American uses 650% more. So for every bushel of wheat the average American eats, you actually use 6.5 bushels of corn. Why is that? If we use a quick example, pull your car into a service station and fill up with some petrol, you use about a bushel of corn in the average SUV because of the ethanol content. That's corn's number two use in the world. If you run inside or your kids run inside and buy those beef jerky sticks to snack on, corn's number one use is to feed those animals. If you wash it all down with something cool to drink, corn's number three use, corn syrup. It's sweetening your drinks. Anybody taking notes using paper of any kind, you pay for all that stuff you just bought at the service station and sign that piece of paper. That's corn's number four use. It's being held together with cornstarch. So it's not possible to operate in the modern global economy in any country without corn and all the other agricultural commodities, but particularly corn, soybeans, and wheat, which are interrelated, and sugar because it makes ethanol in Brazil. It's not possible to not use those products. But the expanding middle class will use more and more and more of it. So you've got a rising global population. You've got competition for land and water. You've got people using more stuff and more things in which these agricultural commodities now are a part. Then you have inherent supply uncertainties. So while the demand is rising, and it's constantly rising, every year the combined use, global use of corn, soybeans, and wheat rises. And it's been doing so for a very long time. However, the supply, there's a supply disruption every 5 to 7 years. Statistically, if you look back, every 5 to 7 years, it doesn't rain somewhere. If it doesn't rain in some spot unknown to us, we're still going to drive our cars. We're still going to, you know, eat a pizza. We're still going to consume a lot of things. And so agricultural commodities are very unique, and here's the secret. I know a lot of people that bought gold at $200 an ounce. It went to $400, to $800, to $1,800, back to $1,200. Most people think at some point it'll go to, you know, $2,000, $5,000. Probably will. But if you bought and hold ags, you have a zero inflation-adjusted return. Why is that? Because agriculture gets planted every year. You put a seed in the ground, it grows, and we use it. There's about, I think it's about 50 days of corn supplies in the world at the end of any given crop year that's extra. So if seeds were not going to grow the next year, and this is applicable for all ags, you have a problem. And if there's even the slightest hint of a supply disruption that seeds aren't growing or aren't growing properly of any agricultural commodity, the price explodes. Why is that? Because we have very low stocks, we can't hold them, and we're not going to stop using them. And so the secret to ags is that when their price goes up, every farmer in the world that can plant that particular agricultural product plants it, and the price goes immediately back down to its cost of production. The interesting part right now is that we're in our fifth year of what looks to be very good growing conditions around the world for corn. Every 5 to 7 years, there's a price disruption. Corn has been sitting at or near its cost of production for 4 years. This will be the fifth year. Wheat starting to creep higher. No rain in the Ukraine. No rain in North Dakota and South Dakota. 4 million less acres planted last year this year than last year in the United States. When there's the potential for a supply disruption on ags, prices really, in the last 10 years, corn prices have doubled twice from their cost of production from the same spot, about $4 a bushel, slightly under. Wheat prices have doubled twice. Soybean prices have doubled twice. It's an asset allocation. I think that commodities in general, and particularly ags, it's not a trade. So you allocate to them X percent. When it stops raining somewhere, they become 2X or more. Reduce it back down to 1X. I think that's the outlook for ags for us. It's very tenuous right now in terms of we've never gone 4 years in a row without stocks declining in, say, wheat. And here we are 5 years into really good growing conditions for corn and soybeans.
All right, thank you. So next, my question is for Kurt, and you have a unique approach to getting broad exposure to commodities. Mm-hmm. If we have time, we'll get into the process a little later, but where are you seeing values in commodities right now?
So right now, the sector that we're most constructive on is in industrial metals, actually. And I think that if you look at the data, that metals are relatively tighter than a lot of the energy products, which continue to be oversupplied. In fact, the weakness in oil going back over the last 3 years was really not a demand problem. It was a supply problem. We had an incredible amount of supply brought up from expanded fracking in the United States. And that technology innovation has become more and more efficient year after year. We're not seeing that kind of oversupply in the metal sector to nearly the same degree. And that really is what guides our investment process, is looking for scarcity, the intersection of supply and demand. And you can look at the returns. The broad BCOM index, is down quite a bit this year. If you look at energy, BCOM might be down 10-ish%. The energy sector, which often I think gets too much attention, too much focus, is down about 25% year to date. And in fact, even if you look at 2016, it's sometimes reported that oil was up 45%. Well, that's spot oil. That's not investable oil. If you buy physical spot oil, you have to store it. And the futures reflects that. So a rolling investment in futures in oil last year made 7%. So transition to industrial metals, and this year industrial metals are up 3-4%. Actually positive return year to date. Big difference in price performance in the first half versus diversified energy. So that's really what we like the most. We're sort of neutral on energy, tend to be a little bit light right now in grains and in softs, and probably a little more positive in livestock, which you can think of as a grains play. It's really, you make cows and hogs by giving them corn and soybean meal and water and thyme.
All right, thank you. And Max, so you publish a precious metals monitor that looks at return drivers, flows, sentiment positioning, outlooks. So what are you seeing just within the precious metal space?
It's very fitting you ask a guy named Max Gold to talk about precious metals. But certainly I think that, precious metals are sort of the one sector that's sort of the top performer in the broad commodity space. And I think what drives precious metals is a little bit more distinct from the broader cyclical commodities like energy, industrial metals, ags. And where I see precious metals going is I think there's a lot of tailwinds, a lot of reason to be constructive for precious metals going into this year and next year. Certainly we've been at a turning point at the end of 2015 and last year where we sort of hit net negative sentiment, net outflows into products and investments like ETFs, physically backed ETFs. But overall we're seeing is sort of the case for precious metals to be, continue to find support, and certainly those cyclical precious metals like silver, platinum, palladium, which are used much more for industrial applications, will in my view, I think, continue to outperform positively and outperform gold for the next year or two, driven on inflationary factors as well as increasing manufacturing and industrial production. And so with that, we are seeing strong fundamentals. We're continuing to see mine production cutbacks globally for precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And we're seeing demand continue to increase. A big part of that demand has really been the return of investment demand in recent years. Overall investment demand does make up a large part of gold. It makes up about one-third of, about 25%, one-third of annual demand. But overall, what drives gold and silver is a much more higher factor towards jewelry. So as we do see more cyclical drivers, we do see wages begin to increase and GDP begin to rebound, we'll see more discretionary purchases on those cyclical sources of demand. And where we see gold right now is, I think, priced about fairly valued, but I do see that if we hit more inflation surprises or a little bit more disruption, really from disappointment on the fiscal policy side, which is sort of the anchor of what's supporting current equity valuations, that we could see gold certainly go much higher if we do see some kind of volatility or event in markets or some kind of a sell-off. So I think that right now the case for precious metals remains strong, especially with where real interest rates are. You know, real interest rates, particularly for gold, are one of the biggest drivers of prices. If we see real interest rates begin to pick up above 2%, that becomes disadvantageous for gold, silver, and platinum. But below 2%, we do see historically positive average monthly returns. Right now, where we are, we're at about 45, 50 basis points on a real interest rate basis. That's in a tightening cycle. That's in still a moderate inflationary environment. And where we see real interest rates remain range-bound and near zero, I think that's an attractive environment for precious metals to continue to perform positively.
All right, thanks. So we have about 7 minutes left. I have a lot more questions than we have time for, but I wanted to pause to see if there's questions from the audience.
Thank you. Mr. Gilberti made a very persuasive case for the efficiency of futures-based ETFs. But I'd like to ask you, when is the timing right for appreciation as opposed to hedging? When is the timing right? What are the buy signals?
You mean to go after absolute returns using futures? Or okay. If I knew that every day, I probably would own this building. But No. What you have to look at, the markets will send you signals. So when a market is in contango, and which people view as a negative roll yield and things like that, that's the market telling you there's enough supply versus the demand. When it goes the other way, that's the market telling you that there's more demand than available supply right then, and that they think will be available. That situation is going to stay. If you can see that coming, that's the time to buy. So there, the USCI, I think, has some formulas that looks into that on a broad base. But in terms of specific tactical allocation to a single commodity, I was trained at Cargill. So if when we were trading gasoline and blending it, the joke was you poured gasoline on your cereal in the morning, and that's what you had, not milk. You have to live, breathe, and think it. So unless you're really, really good and really focused on that particular commodity, I would advise allocation, basically, and rebalancing other than trading. If you're looking to trade, that's a whole different discussion we can take offline. Everybody has a different answer to that.
I think also diversification is one of the free lunches that we don't necessarily take advantage enough of. When you think about strategic allocation, you come with your pie chart of asset allocation weights. I think that commodities deserve a role there, but predicting where the market's going to go is very, very hard. So if you look backwards in time, though, like let's look at this last five-year sell-off in commodities, you can decompose the BCOM or the Summerhaven Index and just look at dollar strength and weakness as one factor, and look at positive or negative inflation changes as a second factor, run regression, and you'll be able to explain 50 to 70%, maybe even 80% of the sell-off in commodities just by dollar strength and the fact that inflation has gone lower. So you might use those as a guidepost. I think we've been in a very, very unusual time. We've had huge amount of quantitative easing, trillions of dollars printed, and no inflationary pressures. We now have unemployment sitting well below 5% for at least a couple more years, according to Fed's expectations. And that's really strange. We've also had interest rates artificially set at zero for about 6-7 years. That hasn't happened since the 1930s after the Depression. So we're a little bit off the map, without a compass to know exactly what is going to happen. But we do know that stocks and bonds are at maybe 85th to 90th percentile returns historically this decade. And if you're in a 60-40 stock bond portfolio, with both of those kind of pricey, you're sitting at maybe 95th percentile for historical returns. And commodities this decade are at the 5th percentile. I think that those are some of the factors you might consider if you want to focus on timing.
Did you have a question? Can you share your thoughts on uranium and how it plays in the overall spectrum and what instruments there are in the market to get exposure?
Now, We trade liquid commodity futures. We only trade on major global exchanges. So uranium has not been something that you can trade on an exchange. I think the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would probably have issue if we took a lot of physical delivery. There are some interesting metals to trade that only trade in the in a swap market over the counter or by contract. Steel is an example, huge commodity. I don't know a lot about uranium trading, but I don't know if my colleagues up here can answer that.
My son actually asked me that same question a few weeks ago, and I didn't have the answer, and I still don't. I think it goes back to get involved in the companies that actually are involved in uranium. That's your proxy right now.
Yeah, there was an ETF that I believe it was nuclear and uranium. I'm not sure if it's still in existence today or not, but it was playing the equities that are involved in that business.
Will nat gas ever go up?
I was actually on the natural gas committee of the NYMEX when they launched that futures contract. And I was one of the first six natural gas basis traders in the country when Reagan deregulated natural gas. And it will eventually, but it's a landlocked market. It's unique to the United States. And the fracking that has come, basically Pennsylvania is a gigantic affordable natural gas basin that isn't going away. And it's been such a great benefit to New York City and the New York City area. The fundamentals in natural gas in terms of the fracking technology and what's come, other than extreme cold or some event that no one can predict, natural gas is pretty limited upside for a very long time, is my opinion.
I would just jump in and throw that, natural gas is much more of a seasonal commodity compared to, say, crude oil. And so there's a lot more seasonal factors in terms of production and ability to drill. Additionally, I think that, take into account maybe a longer-term perspective, is if you look at U.S. Energy consumption of net new production of energy last year, the majority wasn't focused on fossil fuels like coal, which gets a lot of headlines right now. It was actually natural gas, solar, and wind actually made up the largest contribution of net new energy production in the U.S. And so I don't think that trend is going to persist. I think it will persist. It's not going to be disrupted. And so I think that certainly natural gas is an area to continue to keep a focus on, particularly with more discussions around NAFTA trade, as well as the U.S. beginning to think about exporting some of its production of shale oil and gas, particularly in natural gas.
I'd like to thank our panelists. That's all we have time for. I definitely learned something today. I hope you did as well.
Thank you.